The Psychoanalysis Podcast explores the ways that horror movies examine mental health issues. It deals with mature and sometimes disturbing subject matter, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. It is meant for entertainment purposes only, and not as a substitute for proper therapy. If you or a loved one are currently experiencing mental health difficulties, please contact your local mental health center.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
This is Psychoanalysis, a horror therapy podcast, analyzing the horror genre through the lens of mental health. I am Mike Snoonian. Jen is going to be out this week. As we said last time, she's going to be taking a few weeks off to kind of rest up, recharge the battery, and then hit the rest of the year running. But I am not alone. So this week we have a comfort horror episode. And as you know, we define comfort horror as the movies that bring us some joy, that kind of bring us some spirit when we're down and out. It's the things we go to over and over again. And in order to talk about this week's episode, I'm joined by a really special guest. He is the co-director of such indie horror titles as Yellow Brick Road and We Go On, and he is the writer and director of The Witch in the Window. His latest film, The Harbinger, hit video on demand services this past December, and was recently featured as the cover story on the latest issue of Rue Morgue. Please welcome Mr. Andy Mitten to the show. Andy, how are we?
I'm great, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. I mean, I'm recovering from illness, but I think we're going to get through this one all right. So
I believe in us. I do. I'm really happy. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Absolutely thrilled too. And I think it's ironic that I am sick as we talk about your movie about illness. It just kind of adds to the ambiance. So Andy, before we start, can you tell listeners what movie you chose for our comfort horror episode today?
Yes, for our comfort horror episode, I have chosen Friday the 13th Part 2.
Excellent choice. I am really looking forward to diving into this one with you. But before we talk about that movie, let's talk a little bit about your movie. And listeners, go back and listen to our previous episode where we talk about The Harbinger as part of our coverage of COVID for the month of January. But, and I wanted to ask, like, when you conceptualized The Harbinger, was there any pushback from your producers in terms of saying, hey, maybe we don't want to, like, do a movie that is, like, so in the middle of COVID? Did you ever get any pushback on that at all?
Not really. What we had a discussion, and I have a really great relationship with both Richard King and Clark Freeman, who were on board early for this, but it was Richard I was talking to at the outset. And I think probably because I opened that phone call already pushing back on myself. I wasn't like, we have to do this. I was like, let's make the list here. Let's go for the pros and cons and try and, you know, I did have one trusted friend really trying to convince me to put it in a parallel space, to just remove some of the specifics, and not get at it so clearly. But, you know, in the end, Richard agreed and Clark agreed that, it's irresistible to have this shared well of dread globally. I think despite the temptation to just put it away as fast as we can, it's a good thing to look at it if you can do it with a bit of grace, you know, hopefully just a touch of insight, but also just humility, humanity, and like that horror cushion, that lens that just gives you that little bit of distance. You can still build your little roller coaster in there and satisfy, you know, the needs. And that's what I've learned about the community is that they, if you're sort of story first, that they're going to be willing to look at anything. And yeah. So it's like, let's take the swing. Let's try and be that movie that people say, okay, you know, here's the exception. Here's one you should see.
What did some of those internal discussions look like? Like what sort of conflicts when you were doing your, should I or shouldn't I list? What were you thinking?
Well, for one thing, we couldn't see in front of us at that point. We were having this conversation in August of 2020. So, you know, we knew at that point vaccines were coming, but we didn't know when. We assumed we would be shooting without them. We didn't know by the time we released the movie, would we still be in this same hell? Would we be on it? Would we be in some ebb and flow of it? Would we feel over the hill? What would be the desire for escapism? And I knew I would want that. Like, I'm still not ready for a straight drama about whatever that like James McAvoy movie they made. It's just like, you know, people I love in it, but it's just like a straight drama about COVID. I'm not ready. So we just tried to ask ourselves what we want as fans and what we were willing to look at. And it also let us shoot it more safely to acknowledge its existence and live in its existence. That became part of our production plan. So it's all very intertwined.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about that because I imagine, I mean, just trying to isolate as a family was difficult during the COVID times. And I know you said you conceptualized this around August of 2020. And that, I know for us, that was roughly the time where like my daughter, who was 10 at the time, had a near breakdown because she hadn't seen her friends in months. It was her birthday in June. And we had to make a decision as a family, like, okay, we're going to start to allow a couple of her friends into our bubble, but we're going to start still continue to be really careful above and beyond that. What were some of the precautions and protocols you had to consider when creating like a movie, which even the smallest movie is a team of like a dozen at least in order to get everything done? How hard was it to put everything together logistically?
It was very, very hard. Most of that credit goes to Richard King. I mean, you start by acknowledging the SAG guidelines, which had been established at the time and were pretty stringent, especially for small shows. They were big studios sending their movies out with the knowledge that if something happened, they could shut down for a week or two. That was happening left and right. But we didn't have that safety net. We didn't have anyone over us. We didn't have any structure. We had what we had. So we had to meet those guidelines and then go beyond into what was truly making our crew comfortable. And part of that was asking that question of the people who were coming on set, like, what would make you comfortable right now? What would give you peace of mind beyond what it says in the paperwork? Because if we can't relax together, we can't do this.
Right.
So yeah, we had, it was a lot. We were, of course, double masked with a lot of the crew with the actual barriers in front of their faces. And we were testing constantly. And we had these really loud air filters running whenever we weren't shooting. So we were trying to screaming over these air filters between takes and not being able to read each other's faces, of course, learning how to read each other's eyes. So there was a lot, but it was all like, once you get going, you're not going anywhere else. So if you've all tested at negative for a day and you're on an indie set, you're working 14, 15 hours or whatever the hell, like you're going to be okay. And then you don't really worry till the next day off and you worry and you're like, careful where you go.
Yeah. What was the sort of like personal cost for you? Meaning it must have been like difficult to be away from, you know, family at a time where everybody just wants to be around their loved ones. Cause you're thinking like, this could be it. I don't know when I'm going to get to like hug my parents again or my sister again.
Yeah.
How hard was it to be away from your own family during this time?
Really hard. Cause we were in a tight bubble. We were, you know, I was surrounded by crew who had been working actually, like they were all more accustomed to it than I was. I was really coming from the same kind of bubble you're describing and that we depict in the film. So, yeah, for me, the saving grace was this was a really warm set and there was a lot of big-hearted people on this show. So like if it had felt like the kind of set that feels like a war when you're like, that would have really taken it out of me. But I was into it. I had their full support and I even got to work with them halfway through the shoot, albeit over Zoom since my wife and kids were all in the movie for a few minutes there.
Is it hard to direct your kids even for like a brief scene? Is it hard to slip from like parent mode to, you know, working director mode?
I didn't do a lot to try.
You do the Kubrick route? Do you make your kids do like 80 takes and try to wear them down? Like just,
no,
this is a sad scene. Think about your cat getting really sick. You know?
as few as possible. No, they were, I wrote it knowing the only way this would work is if I wrote it being exactly how they would be. So, you know, clamoring around, you know, the best direction in the world for them is annoy mommy. Don't let her talk. And then, you know, when the time comes to run for screen time, go to screen time. And like after a couple takes, the screen time was real so that Laura could finish the scene.
Excellent.
And my father-in-law was like gaffing and moving lights around. It was all pretty funny. It was a good day for me. It was one of my favorite
Excellent.
Days.
With regard to some of the themes of the movie, any movie that deals so overtly with nightmares is going to, you know, draw comparison to Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street or Don Coscarelli's Phantasm. Was there anything you wanted to do with The Harbinger to kind of make it unique, which I think it is, like to handle the nightmare world in a new and unique way?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about it. Yes, anyone working in dreams and horror are standing on Freddy's shoulders, and you got to just be happy to do it. But there is more to explore. And so the best contrast for me was like, you know, ground it in humanity and some of the things that I've been trying to build as my own strengths. So if we were looking to any film, we were looking to Jacob's Ladder, which is, for me, the most human and grounded of the dreamy horror movies. And it also has this really warm-hearted protagonist at the center of it, which is what I wanted. So for us, the rules became about everything is about Monique and our experience with her. And if she doesn't know it's a dream, we better not know it's a dream. So we're not going to change the design. We're not going to infuse a lot of extra sound or score. We're going to trust this experience to sort of help us build the dread. And you know, past that, you make what decisions you do, and then you put it down and you trust that like it's going to be distinct because we're, you know, it's an unusual thing. I feel like my muse works the way she works, and all these elements are going to combine to have a fingerprint, hopefully, at the end of the day.
Did you draw from any of your own like unique nightmares or experiences in coming up with this? Was there anything that kind of like stuck in your head that's like, oof?
Yeah. Well, I was having nightmares when I wrote and when we shot. Unfortunately, that was terrible because when I needed to sleep the most at the end of the day, it was bad. But I like dream logic. Like another movie I drew on a lot is Mulholland Drive, because I always think of that scene where the guy in the diner, you know, tells you about his dream before then we go out behind the diner to see the homeless man, the subject of his dream. And there's something about seeing how scared somebody is of something before you go to it that really builds dread in a fascinating way and kind of goes against conventional wisdom of like, don't tip your hat. But there was a bit that the Harbinger's working on that theory in a grand way, because when we first hear about the nightmares, it's almost like a play, because they're not the character we're hardwired to. So we're going to hear about them and we're going to see how scared she is. And I'm going to try and play the long game with that same Mulholland Drive tactic, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That remains one of the best scares. So that's fantastic comparison. What drew me into this movie, and you know, we've spoken about this before out at Telluride, and I'm sure that I've mentioned it in the previous episode, is like this is one of the rare movies that really scared me as a horror. Like, God, I remember seeing this for the first time and going home, falling asleep around midnight, and at 2:30 in the morning, waking up from like an awful dream. So thank you for that.
You're welcome, I think.
Yeah, which is, I mean, you kind of want that. You're always looking for that as a horror fan. Like, you want to be scared again. Like, that's why we hopefully got into these movies to begin with. But it was not great waking up alone and like wondering, can I call my wife back home? Is it too early to reach out? What really terrifies me about your movie is not just that the plague demon kills you, but it drags you out of existence, like so that you were never even there and no one remembers you. And it feels like so specific to COVID, because the sheer number of people that we've lost since 2020 to this feels overwhelming. in that it no longer becomes about individual stories. It just becomes this number that you get, I really think that we get numb to over time. Can you talk about why specifically you made that a part of the story?
Well, that was the click moment where I knew I had something, because prior to COVID, I had been wanting to work with, I have a few different outlines of different stories, but where when people are off in the story, they're erased. And that was more out of, it's a fascination for that, almost on a technical level, that I used to have of like, if I do that, I get to skip search parties and detectives and all the things I don't like about writing genre scripts sometimes, you know? And I like something that's propulsive like that and sort of jagged. And when I was living in that existential dread we were all feeling that summer 2020, and feeling the loss of, as you say, those swaths of life we lost at a time, and without people being able to go help each other, be with each other at a bedside, go to each other when they needed help, you begin to realize that our identity is dependent, like the fabric of our identity is relationships. And it's good to be reminded of that, but it's the hardest way we could have been. And that fabric, the dissolution of that fabric was a terrifying feeling. And all of a sudden I realized that was sort of the best sort of gasoline for this other idea that had been swirling around my head, and it all just fit together. And then I just took the ball and ran with it.
Excellent. How about the actual visual image of the plague demon, where, you know, it's a pretty familiar visual, but I think it's adapted really well to this. Can you talk about how you adapted it, him or it, and made it unique to this story?
Yeah. It was, what I knew is that, it's always scared me before we had the context or anything like it scares me, certain masks and Eyes Wide Shut. I even talk about like Spy versus Spy cartoons sort of freaked me out because just beaked people are wrong.
Yep.
And so I started, you know, what I wanted is to take a familiar image, but that familiar image is often placed in a certain time period, often with the hat. He's usually wearing the brimmed hat, but we went with the cloak. Every decision we made was like, can we make it feel ancient?
Sure.
And a timeless thing that's been spinning through time and you know, in different versions, and take the thing we're familiar with and kind of extend it. And that, so Myung Hui Park was our special effects designer and responsible for a lot of the magic that happened there. And just, we chose a bird that had the right angle on the beak. I think it was a California thrasher.
Yeah, okay.
Random trivia, and just extended it as long as we could to the point where Jay, the actor who was wearing it, could actually maneuver with, you know, with the weight of it, and try to balance all those things, but give it some organic textures. So the more we revealed it, the less it looked like a mask, and the more it looked like something that might bleed if you dug your fingers in.
Yep. Excellent. It's a super creepy visual. It is absolutely horrifying, and I think that's why. It feels like audiences have connected with this movie. I know that we had like 2 standing room only screenings for it out in Colorado. But what you've been able to tour with this movie since its debut, what do you feel the response has been?
It's been really, really positive. It's, you know, it's a little bit more like Witch in the Window is probably the only other of my movies I've run a proper circuit for. So that was a little different. In that movie kind of sneaks in the back door, and like this movie's a little bit more front footed and dealing with polarizing things. So every now and then I was braced for just backlash, to be honest, by the time it came out. So like to be, to have it be certainly my best critical, sort of success so far, it seems to be mirrored in general audiences to a degree. Yeah. There's some people who like don't want to look at it, and I don't blame them at all, but thankfully there's enough of them that do and that appreciate, as you say, like it seems to be scaring people, and I know that for me that's rare. So if the movie's doing that for people, I think that's a big win, and that's what I feel in the theaters. Like I've stopped watching it, so when it plays in a festival, I'll now, you know, go to the bar, and it's funny because you know, now I'm sort of released from it. So I'll be 2.5 beers in when we get to the Q&A, and sure. I'll walk into the movie theater all light and like, and then I'll see them with the weight of the movie and yep. be like, oh yeah, I have to go to that place. Oh, I'm sorry. I did that.
So you can't have like 10 shots beforehand and be all cheery.
No. Although James from XYZ tried that in Austin when we were at Alamo. He took us to a tiki bar and like started feeding us. I was like, and he was moderating the
How Q&A. Did that go?
It was really fun. That was great. For just that once. It was my first time in Austin. So like, you know, go and make a splash.
Yep. I mean, we saw like the last time we showed it, you know, we saw like some very visceral responses from the audiences during the Q&A. Like we had a pair of women up front that were in tears, like kind of, yeah. I think this movie brought back a lot of like what, and you know, I'm talking about COVID in the past tense as I have it right now. But we think of those like early days when there was so much fear and we lost so many more people. And I think that's like, it hits in all the right feels. It's definitely not a feel good movie, but it's just so well done. And I guess we know it's on video on demand. What about a physical release for this movie?
It's in the works. I'm not able to announce anything specific, but there are plans for a physical release and to do some special features and stuff. That's
excellent. Cool. Excellent. Because I think, you know, we see like HBO right now and what's going on with Zaslav, like basically removing things. It's like if this were to not get, if nothing gets a physical release, like you can, your art, all of your projects can just like disappear like they were never there. It would be a horrible irony.
I'm happy to see it coming back into style and being, you know, you get companies like, you know, Vinegar Syndrome or places like that who do like a bang up job, you know, with the art and everything too. And that the quality of that rises. And look, director's commentary, that was my film school. So that it's important to me.
Yeah. So finally, what's next for you?
I don't know for sure, but I have a few things in development that seem really, really promising. Mm-hmm. I'm too jaded to say, you know, I'll ruin it. I'll jinx it if I announce anything specific, but I have, you know, like a lot of writers in the pandemic, it was a good time for writing.
Yep.
And I've got my scripts stacked up and more things coming out. And I've met a lot of new people through this process, and specifically through working with XYZ, who we want to keep working with as well. So it's looking good that, you know, for me, I'm looking to come into my prime with, you know, even a little, just out of the micro budget level, even one tier up, to have more than 14 days to shoot something.
Sure.
Or like some of my scripts just require a little bit more. So I'm excited to grow into new spaces and maybe explore, you know, directing some TV for something, or, you know, adapting a book I love, something else would be fun too.
How possible is it for you to kind of like take that next tier up? I think we are seeing, like, you know, you're part, I would say, of like a movement or generation of horror filmmakers, along with, say, like Joe Bagos, Benson and Moorhead, Jeremy Gardner, that have started out with like a number of like small indie films, with micro budgeted films that look and perform much better than their budgets belie. And now we're seeing some of these filmmakers take that next step. Why is it horror allows filmmakers to do that, to kind of grow over time?
I mean, there's nothing you can't explore, and it's one space where, you know, like I haven't had a lot of name actors in my movie. Like the priority on that, like if you can scare the horror community, like you're saying, like if you can come out with something that breaks through the noise and feels sincere, like the community is part of what lifts you through that time, and, you know, and helps you to grow. And I think there, some of the execs at these other companies are younger, and these companies are looking in, you know, under 5 million range a lot more in genre as a place to really make a profit and actually also make something cool. It doesn't have to, that can break some rules. You know, you can make a barbarian, you can make, you know, something that's like structurally inventive. And I think the more kind of young Hollywood grows into these new seats who are some of them coming from our community directly, the more that's going to be able to happen. So yeah, those are the people I aspire to. And I see people like Rob Savage or Patrick Bryce, you know, people like that. Yeah. I just want to get happily in that line. Hopefully hope that can happen for me too.
Well, listeners, I'll remind you, if you haven't already, go out and you can purchase or rent the Harbinger. And there are 2022 horror movies named The Harbinger, just to make things confusing. You know, if you got a little bit of extra Christmas money, buy both. I haven't seen the other one, but this is the one from Andy Mitten. So please go out, support this movie, and go back and listen to our episode on The Harbinger as we dive more into the movie proper in the previous episode. So Andy, thanks so much for talking about the film, but now let's move ahead. Let's go back to a simpler time when, you know, rather than everybody isolating, we were skinny dipping and getting cut up by mutant hillbillies. So,
yes, please.
Before we talk about our feelings about the movie, we are going to give you a movie synopsis here. So in case you haven't seen Friday the 13th Part 2 in a while, or you haven't seen it at all, which if you haven't, go back and watch that first, and you're in for a treat. It's such a fun movie. We want to remind you that there are spoilers, and these spoilers have a death curse. Andy, I want to ask, would you mind, we have like this bullet pointed here. We never do this for the, would you mind if you and I traded off reading these bullet points here?
Happily.
Something we've never done when we've done a recap or synopsis before, but I'll kick it off.
All right.
So a recap of Friday the 13th's last act brings viewers back to a simpler time before home video and streaming put every movie at our fingertips, and there was a better than good chance that the audiences hadn't seen the first one since it had left theaters.
Months after the Crystal Lake Massacre, sole survivor Alice attempts to recover at home, and after checking in with her mother on the phone and taking a brief shower, Alice attempts to settle her nerves by filling her tea kettle on the stove. Bad idea, usually. Sets a clock. A stray cat startles her by jumping in her window. Awesome cat jump scare. Love
it. Yes, it is.
Being an animal. Oh, sorry. That's
you. I got this. That's all right. Being an animal lover, Alice opens her fridge to feed the cat, only to be startled by the worst leftover imaginable, the severed, rotting head of Mrs. Voorhees. Before Alice can react with more than a scream, she's stabbed through the forehead with a screwdriver. On the plus column as a house guest, Jason does take the kettle off the stove before leaving. Very polite.
Yes. 5 years later, a new group of camp counselors led by Paul and Ginny roll into Camp Crystal Lake. Ginny is a child psychology student, so you know we love her on psychoanalysis.
Woo woo! Love you, Ginny. Paul gives counselors in training and viewers another recap of Jason's backstory around the campfire, just in case we missed it during the opening scene.
Crazy Ralph is there to greet them with blueberry muffins. Just kidding. He tells them they're all doomed, and he probably should have heeded his own advice instead of being a creepy peeping Tom boy as he ever. Yes. But instead, he gets choked to death with barbed wire by Jason hiding behind the world's shortest tree.
Yeah, love that kill. Don't know how Jason got his arms up over that stump. But the next day, Jason skulks about the woods, trailing the counselors as they hike. Only Ginny senses something out there.
Muffin, who's a Shih Tzu, I think, wanders off and heels at Jason's workbook. Cut to hot dog sizzling on the grill, and tip your cap to the editor, folks.
Love this cut. Absolutely love this cut. While most of the crew takes a dip in the lake, a wandering Jeff and Sandra are caught by the sheriff after they stumble upon the remains of an eviscerated dog. He escorts them back to camp and scolds Paul for not keeping tighter control of his staff.
And Paul lays down the hammer by withholding second dessert for his wayward crew, and it's the second worst thing that will happen to them that day.
Yes, it will be. Driving away from the camp, the sheriff sees a hooded man run across the road and into the woods. He gives chase until stumbling upon a dilapidated cabin. Once inside, he comes across something horrific, but before we see it, Jason buries the business end of a claw hammer into the back of the sheriff's skull.
That evening, Paul and Ginny take half the crew out for a night in the town, leaving the sacrificial lambs behind.
Taryn heads to the lake for a skinny dip. Scotty steals her clothes in a move that was probably like cheeky good fun in 1981, but would get you Me Too'd pretty quickly.
That's for sure.
In this current environment, he gets caught in a trap that leaves him hanging by his foot upside down from a tree. When Taryn flees to get help, Jason appears and cuts Scott's throat with a machete.
Taryn returns, finding Scott's hanging corpse, and just starts screaming into the camera, 80s style, until
we cut to a honky-tonk bar. A live band tears it up for a packed crowd of locals while jokester Ted pounds back the Budweiser tall boys. Meanwhile, the more somber and sober Ginny tries to dissect the psychology behind a theoretically alive Jason's motivation, if he were to actually exist.
Yeah, she goes deep right there. Back at the cabin, Mark and Vicky play video games, with the winner getting to choose, quote, position. We love sex positive Vicky. She asks Mark how he got into his wheelchair, and she asks him if it's just his legs that don't work. Does everything else still work? He assures her he does all right.
Oh, I do all right.
Yeah, it's that. Fine. They start to make out, and she leaves to freshen up.
In what might be the cruelest death of the franchise, Mark takes a machete to the face. I'll take this next bullet point, too.
Yes.
Mark takes a machete to the face, and his chair rolls down a massive flight of stairs. Jeff and underage Sandra, yikes, hook up. Jason wanders in with a spear and thinks, is this that newfangled thing they call pegging that everyone's talking about? And shoves it through Jeff's back and through the both of them, impaling them onto the bed.
Ginny and Paul head back to camp, leaving Ted and the rest of the counselors behind to party. Do you think Ted was more bummed out that all his friends were brutally murdered, or that he would have to start hunting for a summer job all over again so late into the season?
Could go either way with that one.
It could.
Vicky wanders back upstairs and finds Baghead Jason. He stalks her slowly with a knife while she fights her survival by standing still doing nothing until he shoves a kitchen knife deep into her belly.
I like that you had written Baghdad, Jason. Here.
I did. That's, I think, autocorrect. I type this on my phone a lot of the times.
I like that, though. That's intriguing. Paul and Ginny arrive back at camp and are attacked by Jason. He gets the better of Paul and pursues Ginny. After extended game of hide and seek, Ginny runs into the woods, coming upon the cabin we saw earlier. She stumbles into a shrine to Mrs. Voorhees along with a number of Jason's victims, including Alice.
Now I'm thinking Rambo 3, but you replace Rambo with Jason. Ginny decides to put her psychology training to use, donning his mother's sweater and demanding he listens to mother. It fools Jason for a moment, but before she can bury the machete into Jason's skull, he spies his own mother's head behind Ginny and blocks the attempted killing blow.
It's weird that she has the head and she doesn't like keep expecting her to try and like
to wear put it on.
Or, like, put it, it's
oh,
there.
No.
I don't know.
I don't think I'm touching that thing. Ugh.
All right. Sorry. Off ramp. Paul returns and tries to contain Jason. Quick thinking, Ginny grabs the machete as the two men fight, burying it between Jason's neck and shoulder blades.
The wounded lovers head back to the cabin and hear a startling noise, only discover a returning muffin. The couple relax, but hillbilly mutant Jason crashes through the window, pulling Ginny through.
We cut to the next morning. As paramedics load Ginny into a gurney, she cries out, "Where's Paul?"
And we return to Jason's cabin, where the weathered head of his mother is our last visual before we cut to the credits. And end. Excellent. That was quite fun. Thanks for joining in for that. So
thank you.
Your game
was fun.
Wasn't going to make you read the pegging line. We won't do that.
Yeah, I'm glad you took that on.
No problem.
That's good.
So we're going to do a quick feelings check here. It is when we share our first experience with the movie and how it feels when we watch it. So Andy, as our guest, can you tell us a little bit about why you chose Friday the 13th Part 2 for a comfort horror movie?
Yeah, well, when I think comfort horror, I go to my earlier years when, you know, I was discovering it and I was in my safe, most comfortable place, which was like the sort of lower level of the house I grew up in with our old, you know, boxy beast of a television that, you know, that I was always sitting in front of it, but those were the time when, yeah, you put your hand up to the screen and it was like, oh, I really shouldn't sit too close to this thing.
And you get the static coming right off.
Static in your hand. Yeah. So, you know, they used to show these in marathons on like, I don't know if it was USA or like Channel 56, maybe back in the day, or
WLVI.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yep, WLVI. I remember that. The Movie Loft creature feature. Yeah.
Totally. I'm not sure which it was, but I was definitely sneakily staying up for one of those when I first saw this, and it all kind of blurs together in my head, but this one popped out because it's really that like wheelchair death that really pops out first. I wouldn't forget seeing that. And then, yeah, it's just the ultimate, like, I'm home, I'm safe, I'm doing something a little naughty, but it's edited for television, at least when I saw it first.
Yep.
So, you know, I wasn't seeing like the full nudity or anything. Yeah, I got there later. Because then you can make the argument later in the video store, like, Mom, I've seen it. You know,
right.
I know it's good rated point. R, but I've seen it, you know, and she doesn't know better. So, you know, that trick would work. But that first time, it's just the ultimate, like, I'm home, give me some like pizza bagels and some soda and like, some Oreos and a quilt. And I'm just stretched out in front of the TV, happy as I've ever been.
Do you think your kids are going to really like ever understand? Because we have, I think our kids are relatively close to the same age. Like my daughter is 12. Do you think that they're going to miss out on that like visceral thrill of watching something they know they're not supposed to and they couldn't get their hands on it? Like, you know, you either had to like stay up late to watch an R-rated movie on cable because they typically didn't show R-rated movies during the day, or you'd have to go to the video store and hope your parents would rent it or the clerk just didn't care. Like there was something about not just the movie, but the thrill of I'm not supposed to watch this. And our kids are going to miss that.
I know. That's a double-edged sword. I mean, I'd like to think the feeling can be generated other ways. It's certainly not going to be generated by Friday the 13th Part 2 for my children. I'm going to avoid that being the thing for lots of reasons. But I think they'll find ways to get their version of that feeling is what I hope for. But where I worry is that like beyond all the things we weren't supposed to be watching, the things we were supposed to be watching in the 80s had fucking horror in them because like we were just looking at Large Marge. We were watching Christopher Lloyd at the end of Roger Rabbit. It's nothing scarier than Christopher Lloyd with his cartoon eyes at the end of Roger Rabbit. Literally, that stands up to The Exorcist. It was all in there. You know, we had Gremlins giving away Santa Claus. We had Temple of Doom. Like it was insane. And so that is probably good, but I think the pendulum swung a little too far in the other direction. I think we're a little too safe. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to find that line with my kids, but the truth is if I'm always in the room finding that line with them, they're not going to get the feeling you're talking about.
Sure.
I can't be in the room for that feeling.
Oh yeah. I mean, I remember my daughter stuck into the basement when I was watching The Thing and I'm like, look, I'm comfortable. Like she was like 8 or 9 years old. I'm like, I'm not putting you to bed. All right. But if this gives you nightmares, like don't blame me. Okay.
Right.
And I've always been pretty loose about letting her watch stuff. What was it about Baghead Jason specifically that stands out to you?
Well, you know, he doesn't really earn the bag over his head till like almost three quarters of the way through the movie, I noticed recently. So for me, the presence of Jason feels like a continuation of the first. It's a lot of focus on his boots, you know, walking where they're walking in that like classic POV through the forest thing. So my sense of him was that, and then where we see him at the very end, of course, which is a great scare. You know, when I think about the movie, what gives me it's like it holds up today beyond like more than the other ones, because I think it's a really interesting ensemble. Like the characters stick out to me because they're not exactly foils. Like you have a jock in a wheelchair. You have like a nerd who's kind of cool and drinks more than the others. So that's like a mix up of a foil. And I think that struck me even then. I was like, there's something different about this. And And as I grow up, okay, I grew up a while ago. As I continue to evolve and look
we
at it,
we always like, grow. We never stop growing.
But like, it's really well. It's I know it's a directorial debut, and I get the sense there's a really good cinematographer and a really good production designer, you know, being supported and doing their thing. And I looked it up, like the cinematographer, he did Pet Sematary as well. Oh. And Graveyard Shift and Chud, right? So like they're movies that it feels now when I watch it like super ambitious. Like that opening, that the really long take at the top with the first kill, yep. That follows her from the phone and all the way through the house into the shower, and like that's a long, ambitious, really well staged and executed shot. I'm not sure I've seen anything like that anywhere else in the franchise.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like we talk about the first Friday the 13th and, you know, Victor Miller will say, he's like, I took the script to Halloween and I just pretty much mirrored it beat for beat. And you can kind of see that. And this movie also kind of mirrors the first Friday the 13th in a lot of ways, but everything about it just feels like a little bit more. You're getting, you know, you're not usually a sequel, like will diminish the previous movie. You get lesser returns, but it, and maybe it's just the fact that Jason went on to be, you know, such an iconic villain throughout the 80s. But it does feel like a little bit more. What other Friday the 13th would you say, like if you had to pick a few that you would go to, and what does comfort horror mean to you? Like that's something we like to know is like when you think of comfort horror, like what does that turn of phrase even mean to you?
I feel like it's a chemical reaction that you have based on often something in your formative years. It's a nostalgia plus sensory elements. It's mysterious, but like the result is what you said. It's what you put on when you need a safe place to go, when you need a lift. And it says a lot about the time we live in and who we were at that time that like this movie would create that chemical reaction for me. But it does. And a lot of it is in the setting too. Like I look at reasons why this movie or other of the Fridays would elevate. And I think even before I knew when they started filming in like Topanga Canyon, I knew it in my heart. Like I watched, you know, Four, for instance, and I knew it wasn't Crystal Lake anymore. I could tell, like, you know, so the second being shot in Connecticut, you know, in a place that with a proper woods and a proper sort of East Coast vibe, I feel like that stuff comes through, yeah. You know, so it's all about intuition and strange chemistry for me, what creates that result. Yep. But the other ones that do that, I mean, the other ones that are comfort horror for me, certainly the original. I don't care for the third just because it just felt, I don't know, it feels haphazard to me. Like it does, nothing clicks in that movie for me.
You know, it feels like a California movie. Like you said, yeah. It doesn't feel like Crystal Lake at all anymore.
Yeah. And now I understand they were just so wrapped up in the 3D, like trying to figure that out that, you know, the actors I know were frustrated and didn't feel their performances were getting through. So I look to Four as my other comfort. And it's fun to see the more familiar cast and everything in that movie. Yep. And I just like the vibe and the comedy of that movie. And then my other favorite is Six, but that's not a comfort movie. That's just something I, you know, the older you get, the more you see Six and you're like, oh, that's just a fucking cool movie.
It's a step above. Yeah. Same for me. Like I know, I think the first Friday the 13th I actually watched was part 5. Hmm. So I got like the Jason list one. And I think this is the next one that I watch. And I think I skipped the first one because I knew that it wasn't Jason as the killer. I'm like, I want an actual Jason movie. And for the longest time, like this one was my favorite of the franchise. Like I really would go to war for Baghead Jason. And it's still in my top three. I think it's been surpassed by 4 and 6. Mm-hmm. 4 because I think it's such a great ensemble. And as the co-host of old co-host of my other show used to say, Jerry would say, if you took Jason out, it's still a great teen movie. And 6 because you get that meta horror commentary. It's really funny. Yeah. It's an homage to the Universal horror movies. But this still stands out as like a great, like even though it's a it kind of loses the murder mystery aspect of the first one. Like, you know, from Jump Street, all right, this is going to be Jason. It gives you that great horror icon, and it gives you some still like genuinely terrifying shots. Mm-hmm. Like that shot of Jenny in the cabin in the foreground and Jason like balls out sprinting at her. And you just see that is scary. I love running Jason. I think that is so much scarier than just kind of
read. Yeah. And not giant Andre the Giant Jason either. This guy's a normal sized dude. Yep. And it just stands to like, you know, like who that kid, like they talk about it. Who would this kid grow up to be? It's not Kane Hodder, as much as I love Kane Hodder. It's just not. Where, how does he become that dude? That's just Michael Myers. To me, that's just what Michael Myers was always supposed to be, the slow moving, inevitable force. But Jason didn't become that. You know, he evolved into that. And I think this is scarier and it's funnier, you know, like he takes more damage. The guy, he kind of flops around. He has trouble with chairs in this movie.
He does. And trouble. He's genuinely scared. Like use that shot of him like backing away from the chainsaw. And you can see that one eye go huge behind like the potato sack is a great shot. So yeah, this is a comfort horror for me as well. It's probably the one I've seen the most. I did try to watch it with my daughter at one point and she got bored. She was like, all it is everybody trying to have sex and like there's not enough Jason in it. So she actually got up and left at one point. I'm like, well, all right. So
yeah, it's true. I mean, it is the horniest one. I think it is the horniest of the, it was just saying a lot.
Yep.
But it feels, but it also feels like the one where they like the chemistry is the most there. Except for, I know the guy in the wheelchair was gay and didn't, he was, I think, an openly gay man who, but maybe then, it's not there. But like,
even then, like his scenes with Vicky are pretty great.
Oh, he was great. That guy has like a real, I mean, the acting is good. Todd is good. That monologue he has at the campfire with all the counselors with the slow camera push.
Yep.
You know, because for me, that's the thing that this is the most ambitious with the camera. I think even of compared to 4 and 6, the shots that they attempt for a movie that gets called lazy a lot. And because I understand that in the writing, it kind of is, but it definitely was not lazy in the making. You got a first time director and some really great keys.
Let's talk about that specifically. There's no mental health topic this week. It's a comfort horror episode. But let's talk about the movie proper. And I guess, and it's great having a filmmaker on, what do you notice as a difference between Sean Cunningham and Steve Miner in terms of like how they shoot their movie, respective movies? Is there anything that jumps out? You mentioned the camera work with Steve Miner. Is there anything else that jumps out about this movie?
Well, certainly the art design, and that goes into the setting as well. Like if you look in the living spaces of this movie, they are populated with lots of details and props. The kitchen at the beginning, everything in the bathroom, everything about the opening beyond the recap part. I mean, I get that they had to do that, but that's rough. But once we get into that first kill, for me, there was a priority to connectivity in the second movie. The first movie is very jagged and cutty, and I get that. It feels more like an exploitation pick a little bit. It's a little bit more like birthed from the 70s when I see it. But this feels more like people who are interested in and really experiencing that entire walk, and you're going to take the time in a movie like this to light a shot 360 degrees just so you can walk around the house without cutting. You don't see that priority being done very much, and all the cuts feel like they were intentional, which I don't feel like I see in any of the other films, literally, like a cut that's like, oh, that's like exactly as it was designed. This entirely flows. You can see it even being discussed in pre-production. It doesn't feel discovered along the way or haphazard or just for the sake of the horror or the gore. In fact, what's frustrating about part two is you feel the MPAA getting in the way of the movie with every kill. You feel it cutting away too soon. You feel the punches pulled. And that's what's frustrating. I remember feeling that even as a kid, like that kill didn't follow through.
Yeah. Have you watched the Now, have you gotten like the box set with all the movies and gone back and watched like the extended kills that they found like the VHS footage for?
I've seen some of it, and I've seen Crystal Lake Memories?
Yep.
But it's been a while. So I don't, seen the proper versions so many times that it's hard to like even bring that stuff back.
You do feel the MPAA's hand, like it almost feels like they're taking it out on this movie in the subsequent Friday the 13th, because they're like, you got away with one on the first Friday the 13th. Like, we really dropped the ball. So we're going to overcorrect on all of your subsequent movies, to the point where they feel, especially with what we get now, it feels pretty tame. What I noticed too, rewatching this last night, is it's a secretly very funny movie. And there's a very, like, Steve Miner brings this really cheeky sense of humor to it, in that there's no need for Jason to remove the tea kettle from the stove. But it's, you know, it's just like, you can see that with an audience, like, after the shock of seeing, like, the previous movie's heroine killed, then, like, settling back in their chairs with a laugh after seeing that. Or you cut from this tiny Shih Tzu dog to like a half dozen hot dogs grilling under the summer heat. Right. Like, that's just funny. That's like a really neat little filmmaker's touch.
Yeah, agreed. And they're not there. I like how they let, you know, what is it? Crazy. It's funny.
Crazy Ralph.
I think of him as the Harbinger.
Yes.
Which is the one relationship I have to this movie, is I know that's like a horror movie, like, archetype. And he's like the ultimate harbinger, this dude. But he's just, that they have him blatantly, like, you know, peeping in this movie and doing, you know, like, they're not subtle with some of that stuff. And it winds up being, I don't know, kind of charming. And even like in the sex, like, they're sort of giggly, like, fun sex happening in this movie. It's not like Cinemax, like, gross, sweaty. It's sort of like, you know, the only thing gross about it is the 16-year-old.
Yes. And what is the story behind that? Did she like fake her age to get the, okay.
So that is, it wasn't the story. And I didn't know this, so I watched it last night too. And then I looked at some of the trivia stuff, but I noted when she, you know, when they show up in the car at the beginning, like, I was like, she looks young.
Yep.
Like, I made a point to like look at how old she was when she did it. So I'm not sure I would have believed her, whatever she told him. But she had already like shot the sex scene as a 16-year-old with nudity, and they had to cut it out.
That's terrible. That's right. Okay. So yeah, that is, well, thankfully that wasn't reinserted.
No.
Back in. That would have been awful.
Yes.
But you're right. There is, like, you know, Vicky is like a very like sex positive person. Like, I love how she is like actively pursuing Mark, and there's there's like no shame around his like disability. At all. Like, she's very like, hey, I really like you. I think we should like connect with one another. And she's like, just want to make sure, like, she's already into him even before she knows whether or not like he can perform in him. You know, and I like how she's like, we're going to play this video game to see like who gets first position. Like, that's great. And it's not, you know, kind of like gross the way a lot of the sex and a lot of the later Friday the 13th or slasher movies would be.
No, there, it's not predatory, really. You know, Scott walks the line at one point, but Scott, you know, is an asshole. I wish he got the proper, he was set up hanging upside down there for a proper, like, you know, Hostel 2 style bleed out there, like, and it just, we don't quite get it.
Yeah, he is the one very disgusting part of this, you know.
But he also dances with Muffin. He dances with Muffin, you know, so... He can't be all bad. He's a dog lover.
How hard is it to find that balance? Because it feels like after part four, well, part six is a very likable cast. With the exception of part six, it seems like the scales tip. And now it becomes less about, oh, here's a bunch of kids that audiences can maybe see themselves reflected in, to like, here are a bunch of kids we want to see killed as quickly as possible.
Yeah, well, part eight was definitely I remember seeing Takes Manhattan as a kid and was just like, it gave me a bad feeling because everyone yeah, everyone felt kind of dark and wrong and artificial, and any sense of that was gone. So I don't think it's been back. It is a hard thing to find, but you have to want to find it. It has to be at the top of your priority list. And I just think that's, even when they went and started remaking them, I think there's good things about, you know, the modern stuff, but I don't think it ever wanted to be, you know, slick and digital, and, you know, the characters started to feel just like you were plugging them into the categories, and there was no chemistry. I mean, that's the part you really can't fake. And that's why you want to be on location in Connecticut and not everyone driving into Topanga Canyon every day, because when you can like, and I know well, cause I've tried it both ways, like your onset chemistry goes directly into the movie. If you can be on location, that vibe, it really helps.
And you're all holed up in the same hotel after, you know, you're not going home, you know, they have that whole scene at the honky tonk bar. I'm sure that like that cast and crew was spending every night, like in that bar or bars like it,
absolutely,
like throwing them back afterwards and like kind of having that vibe. And so you can have like Paul and Ted have like a real kind of chemistry between them, probably because offset they developed a really good chemistry between them. And you had mentioned how there aren't really stereotypes in this movie. Like your jock is in a wheelchair. Your kind of like snooty rich kid is still able to like kind of like make himself humble a little bit and dance with a shih tzu to impress a girl. Mm-hmm. You know, Teddy is the nerd, but he can outdrink you. And it feels like this is before like John Hughes movies became a thing, where you started to have like all of these cliques that were set up in teen movies, where you have your prototypical jock, your rich girl, your outcast, your class clown. You know, before that, you could have like everybody, as we do in real life, everybody could play real roles.
Yes, well put.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you, speaking of roles, like how does Jenny rank for you? Because I feel like if there's a Mount Rushmore of final girls, like Jenny, played by the lovely Amy Steele, has to be near the top of that Mount Rushmore of final girls.
Without a doubt. Completely agreed. I mean, and in a different way than was done during that era. Like she arrives with she arrives and completely does a reversal, because she arrives late, right? And when they're all having their meeting, and she seems like she's going to be the like scattered blonde. Like they set her up that way because she's late and she doesn't quite have it together. And then they go into that office together and you see immediately, oh, she wears the pants in this relationship, but it seems healthy. And you learn they're together. And from that point on, she's a steady, very steady for these movies, you know, like knows how to scream and do the 80s thing, but always is moving forward and leaning into it. And again, has that scene where she's actually trying to see it from Jason's perspective, trying to like take it seriously for a moment, which you never see characters do.
Yep.
So, yeah, she's got to be top three final girls.
Do you think we're to assume that she's pregnant? Because there's that like one moment when she's with Paul in the cabin. She's like, oh, I have something to tell you. And it never goes from there. In between that and like her, she's really like focused on like the mother son relationship between Mrs. Voorhees and Jason. And you can see her kind of like transferring those feelings of, you know, like a mother wanting to protect her son and what it might be like for her son to see his mother killed in front of him. Like I've always assumed that like Jenny is pregnant and it's just like an unspoken thing.
Wow. I mean, it has not occurred to me, but that's absolutely, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think why you would have that line in there. And what I like about Jenny is she is like so smart and resourceful, and like she's like the, you know, what we've seen in Final Girls at this point were still like a developing thing. Like we had seen it with Olivia Hussey in Black Christmas, and Laurie Strode, obviously, with Jamie Lee Curtis, Alice in the first Friday the 13th, but it was
Texas
still
Chainsaw, maybe
Sally with, who still to me, and I've said it before, like Sally, her body escapes, but the rest of her mind is still in that house. Jenny is the first one to actually use psychology to get away. She puts two and two together really quickly, like once she stumbles into the cabin and knowing what she knows about child psychology and we'll say like John Bowlby's attachment theory, like having a role model to grow up with, to look up to, so you can kind of learn social norms and connect with other people. She realizes Jason didn't have that and solely relied on his mother and is able to step in that to that role really quickly. And I love that about her. I love that deep down she realizes like Jason is just this huge, confused, overgrown kid that really just misses his mother.
Tremendous.
I get one good thought for the day.
I've nothing productive to add to that but applause.
Oh, please. Come on. What do we think of Jason in this movie? Like, how does like Baghead Hillbilly Jason compare to what we would see later on?
Yeah, well, I love every iteration, at least up until maybe, you know, the Takes Manhattan.
Yep.
It was maybe when it changed. I can respect all of it, but I think they did need to go forward, like the mask. They needed something to like lay anchor because there wasn't enough behind the persona. So Jason is not what I love most about this movie, nor is his theme, because I realized, I think it evolves into like the like is it ch in the first one?
It's
I don't even remember.
Ki-ki-ki, mama,
it's still first, yeah.
Because it's kill him, mommy, kill him. So
oh right, of course. So yeah, with that, I don't know. That wasn't quite working for me as much in this movie. But like, it's the characters and the setting and the feeling that I love most. And again, like we discussed about Jason, I like his little vulnerabilities. I like his mobility. I like his size. There's enough, you know, that potato sacks, it's got a look. What is the movie it's referencing? It's the direct reference to something,
Town
That
Dreaded Sundown.
There it is. Yep. Yeah. So I'm not familiar with that. So I don't have that reference in my head, but it works for me. I think it's interesting that he rejects the goblin mask in the middle.
Yeah, that's right.
He has an opportunity. He picks it up for a second. He's like, no, that's not me. It's like they're still searching at that point.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense too, because he's just, it's not about hiding his identity as much as like hiding his deformity, and like the sack like lets him kind of hide everything under there.
Well, and hiding what turns out to be some pretty long locks of hair there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the half the 5 o'clock shadow and yeah, I really like this Jason. I like that it's like a more human one. I like that he has to actually hide. Like, you know, when he sees Paul and Ginny in the cabin, like part of him is like, well, technically I'm outnumbered. And he has to figure out, like, how do I avoid? He has to still skulk around a bit. He doesn't appear out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I said it before, like, I love he's a running Jason, but he's also like super awkward. He like falls off chairs. He can't quite get his hands around Jimmy when he tries to grab her in the woods. Like he can't quite beat Paul in physical combat. Like they have to actually wrestle, where, you know, in later movies, he would just pick him up one handed and like snap his neck like it was nothing. There's something like scary and human about this Jason.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it works. And I like that it's not all about jump scares either. It's like, it's actually less emphasis than a Halloween, because they choose a few good ones, but they use a lot of like, you see him coming up behind someone, you'll see his feet coming up behind their feet. And they're more playing a game of like, oh, you know, you get ahead of the characters and saving their jump scares for a few really good ones.
Do you think this Jason deserves a little bit of empathy? Because like, really, all he wants to do is like live out in the woods and survive. And like, he, you know, I look at like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and like Leatherface isn't killing anybody until they break into his house. Like, you know, in another way, you can look at that movie as a home invasion movie where the hippies are the home invaders, you know, and they kind of get what's coming to them. Like Jason isn't really going out of his, well, except for Alice, which is revenge, going out of his way to kill anybody. It's just they're stumbling upon his home turf. Like, does he deserve a little bit of empathy, or are we off base there?
I think at this, if ever, here is the place for a little bit of empathy, right? He's not even in the first one.
Right.
And now, yeah, I think it's the only time, you know, you can look at it that way. And maybe he's not quite respecting the borders of, yes, they cross the border into his camp, but then he really, I think, crosses the border in return. Yep. And comes over there. Yeah. But like, yeah, they, you know, it's like the sheriff says to Todd, it's like, you know, like, it's been a good 5 years. You know, you almost feel that happening in some
yep.
level of the movie studio too. Like someone coming to the audience and like, yeah. really, it's been quiet for 5 years. Are we doing this again? Like, should we be?
Right.
And
it's almost like you yeah. want to like just have a developer come in and turn Crystal Lake into a parking lot or a shopping mall.
Exactly. Right? But you have a camp director in this sort of, you know, Christopher Reeve sort of dude who, you know, in another movie, he would just be bumbling like kind of an asshole. Just like, yeah, we're here. This is what we're doing. Get out of here, Sheriff. But no, he's like a reasonable guy.
Yep.
He kind of, you know, he's trying to look at it realistically and he's trying to run a good camp and yep. he seems to be good at it. These aren't a bunch of just drunks, you know?
No, he's like taking him through the woods to hike. He's talking yeah. about survival. He's like, hey, and he knows when to like, pull back. He's like, look, we're gonna work really hard. Let's go out and have like one last night out. Like, this is the one Friday the 13th where there's like a huge number of survivors, because like half of the counselors who you never really get to see, they're just go to the bar and hang out. And my god, I can't imagine coming back the next day and just being like, wait, what happened? Like,
it's true. It's almost like when they're not drinking, they get really horny, and when they drink, they just get really philosophical about yep. Jason. It's like,
that's great,
they're turning a lot of things on their head there. But there's a lot of reason to like this group of people, you know, more than the others we used
oh yeah
to get.
I think this is one of the most likable group of victims in the whole series. Like mm-hmm. this and part four are kind of neck and neck with me, because they are, and it's a very cute cast as well. Like everybody is in most yeah. of these movies, like they don't really hire any ugly people for these movies.
No.
You know, like Amy Steele is like the quote unquote plain Jane in this movie, and she is like a lovely woman. So it's, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they just have the one, which the girl who plays Terry is the one who's like, okay, we're going to make it clear, you know, all the ugly reasons why you're here. You're going to do the skinny dipping scene.
Yep.
You're never going to wear a bra. We're yeah. just going to wear it. That's
it.
Who they were back then. And, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, at the time I didn't know better. So I was just the recipient of such gifts.
That's right.
Grateful.
Yeah. Oh, 80 slashers have the sexual awakening for many a young teenage yeah. and preteen boy in
oh
the
my
80s.
God. And when they do the full frontal nudity and wide, and those are the moments you're like pausing.
What?
Like, yeah. I think I can. It's way
can
in the
I
distance.
I see everything?
Yes. I can totally see the giant pixels on my beast of a television that's radioactive.
Well, you mentioned how there's like not a reliance on jump scares. What do we think of the final jump scare with Jason coming through the window as a way to kind of, again, mirror the end of the first movie?
I love it. I mean, got me again last night, and I know it's coming. I didn't know quite the rhythm of it. I forgot that they played the cheesy music when Muffin yep. comes in. So it kind of mixes a little Carrie in there. Like you kind of feel like with the last jump scare and Carrie, like they're playing the sweet music. So it's like a combo of that and the end of the first movie. It is not quite as amazing as the first movie's final scare.
Yeah.
But it's a really good swing at like doing something as cool. And
yeah.
you know, in reading about the production, I guess there was a hard shot to get. They got it like three times, and that actress was really scared and nervous
oh, yeah.
about the effect. And I think that comes through in that shot.
Yeah.
I think you can feel her fear. So yeah, I'm thumbs up. Thumbs up to that.
Do you think Paul is dead?
Huh. That's unclear. If Muffin can survive that long, Muffin's good.
She's indestructible.
That's all I know for sure. Yes.
Things are hard to
But
kill.
What animal was eviscerated out in the woods?
There's a lot of animals out there, so.
I don't know. It looked pretty muffiny.
It did look very muffiny. the only other bits I have here, I want to know how Jason got from Camp Crystal Lake to
Annie's house in the first, from the first movie. Like, is he riding Greyhound with like his mother's head in a little bowling sack? Like, that is.
Yeah, his thought process at the top you cannot follow. Also, like, yeah, he's got his sound. I'm going to put it in the fridge.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, it's a great super scare, random.
You know, it's a great, you know.
Yeah.
You got to wonder if he's like, what if she like goes out to eat a lot and just, you know, oh. So the only other thing I had here, just Adrian King, who played, who played Alice in the first movie, says like when she agreed to come back for the second movie, she had no idea that she was going to get killed in the first 5 minutes, which is that possible? Like, I don't think like she would have had a script, wouldn't she, where she could see, like, even if she just perused it without reading it, she would notice that there was no Alice in the other 100 pages after page 5.
I mean, unless the script left the end of that scene, like, didn't have the screwdriver, unless sure. It was like a reveal and a scream and you don't know. I mean, who knows what they gave her, but you'd think that was highly unlikely. Plus, like, if you got to come on for anything, that's like, I mean, that's literally one of my favorite shots in any. I mean, it's just basically doing a one shot for most yep. of her part, and it's freaking great.
Yeah,
I love it. So, hopefully they didn't trick her, but I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there'd be a lot of subterfuge there. I just thought they thought they would, like, all right, this is how we're going to start this movie. And it makes sense to start it that way, given how everything else goes. So,
yeah.
Well, do you have any final thoughts on Friday the 13th Part 2?
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of the things that even made it work so comforting for me when I was young, part of that even is the shame of standing beside this movie.
Shame.
It's part of, yeah, it's a little bit of shame. That's like one of the ingredients. That's one of the ingredients in that like unknowable alchemy we were talking about of a comfort movie. Shame is one of them. I still feel it as I try and defend this movie. There are some indefensible things about this movie, but where it fell in my life and the fact that I can get that feeling about it, and then as a more knowledgeable adult, look at it and see the reasons why it holds up. Because there are other movies that give me that reaction. A good example is Poltergeist 3, yep. right? Poltergeist 3, just because the setting, again, like high rise horror, like I just love everything about the feeling of that movie. But I'm not going to talk about it on a podcast because as an adult, I can't defend it at all. At least Friday the 13th Part 2, I think there's a lot of talent and a lot of heart mm-hmm. and weirdly placed ambition on this movie. So it's fascinated me through the years and kept me coming back and delivering me to the source, right? To that feeling, which is a great place to be reminded of. It keeps you moving on days when you don't want to move.
The fact that you were able to deliver that while based with a straight face while like staring into my other cat's butthole is wonderful.
I was looking right at that it, but clearly, you know, unfazed. You can tell I'm a cat person.
Didn't miss a beat. It's like probably the most impressive thing that's ever happened on this show. Yeah, some of the movies we do comfort horror every other week. And we have guests come on, and every now and then we'll get a movie and the guest will bring it. I'm like, oh, do I really have to do this? Like, and it's so hard. It's like, yep, this is a movie I've watched, I guess, for the show. Like Troll 2 is what we did. And I'm like, do we really have to do this? But hey, to each their own. So yeah, I love this movie. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's one of the better slasher movies of the early 80s. It's got a great cast, some really fun kills, and a really fun portrayal of Jason. So that's Friday the 13th, Part 2. And we are going to move on to our we're going to move on to our uplifting moment. Mm. And this is where we share any grounding or coping techniques or any self-care that's been particularly effective for us. And as a reminder, grounding and self-care are the little tips, tricks, mantras, or practices that help us get us through the hard days or the hard moments. Self-care is anything we do that makes us feel good or feel better about ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, you name it. So the only thing I have like at my job at the school, I've been running like a, what I would call like a coping skills group with sixth graders, seventh graders, and eighth graders, like doing different groups with different one for each age. And we're just using like different things right now. Like we're doing mandalas in order to like give everybody a breather. Like if they need some time to just kind of like let their brain relax, like using those as a technique to kind of slow your brain down and slow your body down a little bit to really focus on a minute activity. And then also having the kids find like their anxiety coping statements. So like during moments where they're feeling stressed out or anxious, giving them something to practice saying, such as like, you know, like my anxiety is bad, but I can get through it, or I'm not defined by my anxiety, or, you know, sometimes it's okay to feel uncomfortable, like letting each kid find their own mantra or two, and then like practicing with them, kind of walking through it and, you know, identifying with them the moments, whether it's before a test, whether it's before, you know, like a class they don't want to go to, or social situations, like letting them lower those levels of anxiety. So it's been kind of fun working with like different groups of kids on that. And Andy, you're under no obligation, but is there anything you want to share for like self-care or anything?
Sure. I mean, I'm a breath person. My main tool in recent years has become, you know, going to counts on my breathing, and, you know, I'll grow it if I have the time, but, you know, inhaling on like a nice 20 count and holding it for five and letting it out on another, you know, 20 or 30. And I can get up, like if I focus on that, I can kind of clear the desktop of anxiety in my head. Yeah. And I also have to remind myself of that, of like, you know, I forget what book it comes from, if it's Eckhart Tolle or whoever, but like, we sometimes put the pressure on our brains to be the whole hard drive when it's supposed to just be the desktop. Mm. So like developing systems and drawers and trusting your computer and your, you know, depending on your actual hard drives, for instance, and remembering that like, we're not like, we just need to keep a nice clean desktop. So grounding, coming back to the, you know, to your breath or to sound. I've discovered ambient music in the last 5 years, and just deep, deep, deep down into that world, because I respond to that. I can listen to a, you know, one chord evolving for 20 minutes while I work.
Wow. Okay.
And just find, you know, it's just done something to my subconscious. So those are my recent tricks, but I, you know, I care a lot about this stuff.
Do you find that you write to that, and do you look for certain tones or notes depending on the mood or feeling that you're trying to go for in your script?
Yes. I mean, if I'm just trying to disappear, or it started by being in a space during the pandemic where I couldn't escape the sound of my children playing, who were home every day from school. So I need these headphones I'm wearing now at full volume, and I can't get quiet. So what can I get? Can I wrap myself in this tone?
Yep.
So I started listening to like Brian Eno, even like going back to some of that old stuff, or Boards of Canada are great. And some of that stuff adds a little percussion or a little friction or some kinetic energy. If I'm like writing, if I know I'm going to write some like kinetic scenes, I like that little friction. But otherwise, I just need a place to support my thoughts and not intrude on them.
Were Boards of Canada that band that had that one track in Sinister?
Oh, if they did, I didn't know about it, but that wouldn't surprise me.
I feel like they have that one track that plays throughout like the last act of Sinister that's like really creepy and has like the kind of like chanting and drumming over it. So
yeah, okay.
I have to go back and find it. But that's one of the best uses of music in any, either way, it's like one of the best uses of music in like a horror movie in decades. So
fantastic.
So our homework, we want to hear from you. Give us your thoughts on Friday the 13th part 2 by following us at PsychoAPod on all the socials. You can email us at psychoapod@gmail.com if you want to share privately. Our homework question this week is, what is your best or worst summer camp or summertime experience? Great question as we now settle into the dog days of winter. And as for what we're watching next, we're going to continue our month-long look back at COVID with Host, a movie that, you know, was the first real kind of like pandemic sensation, Rob Hunter's Host. It's not a movie I love, so I'm kind of looking forward to going. I want to love this movie because listening to Rob Hunter speak about making it, he's someone that I find easy to root for, and I really want to enjoy this movie. So I'm kind of looking forward to the rewatch and see if I appreciate it more now that it's not kind of mired in the hype and expectations that I had at the time.
Sure. Is it Rob Savage?
Yes, Rob Savage. You're right. My bad. Or is it? Hold on.
I think it is, but I could be. I don't trust my brain.
You are correct, Rob Savage. Thank you. Don't know who Rob Hunter is, but I'm sure he's made some lovely movies as yes. well.
Yes.
Whoopsie. So, Andy, where can everyone find you on the socials, and where can they find The Harbinger and your other movies as well?
The Harbinger and my other movies are all the places you might get your movies right now at Apple and Amazon, and Witch in the Window and We Go On are both on Shudder. But you can rent them individually through the other spaces too. I'm on Twitter. Now you have to say it like that. You have to say it with that tone. Like I'm.
If Twitter is still up by the Twitter,
right? Whatever. I've been like making my plan A's, my plan B's, and plan C's at other places. But for the moment, at Andy Mitten on Twitter, totally works. And at Andy Mitten 33 on Instagram are the places I'm living right now.
Okay. And you can find me at Mike_Snoonian. You can follow the show over on Twitter for now at PsychoAPod. We have a pretty active Facebook group. Like it's kind of brewing again. It's a really well moderated group. Everybody that's on there is like super lovely. There's no trolls. So go to Psychoanalysis Podcast Support Group over on Facebook. And we'll post some questions there. I'll do some like cross posting with my other show. You can follow my other show, The Pod and the Pendulum, everywhere you get your podcast. And you can follow me aside from Twitter over on Letterboxd at Mike Chump Change, at Hive at Mike Chump Change, and Instagram at Mike_Snoonian. Become a patron of the show. We have a pretty great Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/psychoanalysispodcast. We'll get you. Every tier gets you bonus episodes. We do, you know, deep dives into other movies and topics. And depending on the tier, you'll get things like our medicine cabinet, where we give you our staff picks and what we're watching or listening to or playing at the moment. We also have at the higher tier, the treatment plan, which is where I will take a character from a horror movie and kind of like diagnose them based on what we see in the movie and maybe come up with like how I would treat them as their therapist. In January, we're looking at Leatherface and not so much doing an actual plan, but talking about developmental disabilities and intellectual disabilities and how they're portrayed and some of the challenges that community faces. So that will be in January over on the Patreon page. But yeah, that's about it. That is our episode on Friday the 13th, part 2. Andy, thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to talk out in Colorado. It's a pleasure to chat here.
Yeah, it's so much fun. I mean, nothing but fun. Honestly, thank you for having me. And I love what you guys are up to here. So this is great.
And I am obviously not more than you, but I'm loving it how much success The Harbinger is having and seeing so many people react in a positive way to it. It's such a great, you know, like it's why I love indie horror so much. And I'm really thrilled to show this to more people. So please, listeners, thank you for spending your time with us. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And if you want to do this little outro with me, Andy, it is time to sign off. We came.
Sorry.
Okay, no problem.
I like lost it.
It is, we came here, it's the, all you have to say after I say my sentence, and we're all out of bubblegum. Ready?
Okay, got it.
We came here to chew bubblegum and take care of ourselves. And we are all out of
bubblegum. Okay, we have to do it one more time. All right. You have to give me one more swing.
You know what? Tell you what. You call action, and then I'll say start with the line, all right?
Ooh, okay. Ready?
Yep.
And action.
We came here to chew bubblegum and take care of ourselves.
And we're all out of
bubblegum. That's about as good as we usually get it. So
that's it.
Excellent. Cut and print.